Welcome to episode number 29 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast. I'm so excited that you've joined us for the show. Thanks for being here and thanks for taking care of yourself and making progress in your personal development. And that's what this program is all about. We want to bring shows to you to help you improve your life, to help you grow toward the person you want to become. So my name is Conrad Weaver, and I'm so grateful to be here, grateful to be a part of this program. Thanks for taking time to listen and to watch this podcast. I really appreciate it. So today I have Jim Starlin on the program. Jim is the CEO and founder of the Team Alpha Critical Incident Diffusion Unit. That's a really mouthful. Jim has a diverse background in about every aspect of the first response community in his 40 years of service. He has quite a resume as a firefighter, a medic, a 911 dispatcher, a corrections officer, an air medical telecommunicator, and a regional emergency manager, and a disaster response mobile field hospital team leader. Jim's now retired from serving as a first responder directly, but he has recently dedicated himself to the care for the caregivers by focusing on their mental wellness. Stay tuned for this conversation as we talk about his idea for a rapid response team who will provide mental health care on active scenes while the trauma is still fresh and manageable. So it's going to be an interesting conversation. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the podcast, and I'm so grateful for everyone who's joining us on our YouTube channel and on all the social media sites and the podcast channels. If you're on a podcast app, like an audio app like Apple Podcasts, I want to invite you to join us on YouTube, where you can watch this interview and all the others. Plus, we have a ton of additional content, including my series recap from my coast-to-coast bicycle tour this past summer. So come on over and subscribe to the Wellness Channel on YouTube, and I'll see you there. So thanks again for listening and for watching. And now here's my conversation with Jim Starlin. Well, Jim, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. Thanks so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
We're doing well. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, so we're doing well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So where exactly is your neighborhood? You're in the Carolinas, I believe?
I'm in Mebane, North Carolina. It's a little town between Winston-Salem and Raleigh. Growing exponentially, and got a lot of work to do here.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your background. I know you've been in the fire service, apparently, because before we started recording, you said you've been to Emmitsburg, Maryland many times. So tell me a little bit about your first responder background.
Well, so I grew up in a small town in northern Michigan, and this is going to tie into a little bit later conversation, had a very tumultuous childhood. Became a first responder after a rather traumatic event involving the witnessing of a motor vehicle accident. And, most first responders, there's several reasons why they get into it. They have either a calling or, they just like to drive fast and with lights and sirens. Or they're trying to right a wrong. And that happened to be my instance. I witnessed this and I said to myself, I'm not going to be helpless in this situation anymore, because I ended up freezing on site for about 20 minutes and I was out of it. And so I came back from our little vacation that I was on and became a firefighter, and then got my EMT license, went on for paramedic. And of course, all our first responders, they have to be busy, right? Doing something with that crazy schedule that everyone has. So I had downtime. So I became a 911 dispatcher. And then there was a part-time offering in that county sheriff's department that I was working for as a corrections officer. So I took that too. And so, it just kind of progressed upward, right? And, one thing led to another. I moved from Michigan down to North Carolina. I took a position at UNC hospitals with their critical care transport unit, as an air medical telecommunicator. And then Hurricane Katrina hit. So I was at UNC for 10 years, responded to, just like thousands of other responders, went down to the Gulf and, helped out with that response. I oversaw a disaster response mobile field hospital for 2 weeks down there, and came back, and I led that state medical assistance team for another 10 years as a regional emergency manager. And that's where it kind of capped. We did that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And just like any other person out there, you know, every stage of that progression through your career lends some memories, whether it be good or bad. And so I came to the realization that the bad were overtaking me, and I needed to just step back and do some just relax for the first time in 30 years. And so I'm,
what were some of those things those maybe symptoms that made you say, there's something not right here? What was showing up in your life?
Well, I think a lot of it was education, for one, realizing and understanding. I took a CISM leadership course, and it actually opened my eyes to a lot of things that I was experiencing that I, like many, don't know that that's what's going on. And so I delved into that a little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more. And then in 2000, paramedic school, we spent a total of about 15 minutes talking about what was the job, what was the job, not just helping people, but how it impacted and how it was going to change our life. And, that really resonated with me that we only spent 10 to 15 minutes on something so important. So, that's what brought everything to light. And, PTSD, and I hate that term. It's an injury. It's, there's a disorder component, but, it's huge. And so starting to realize what exactly it was, brought me around to understanding where I was at in life. So.
And so in your, once you kind of understood that, what did you do? What was your action step to kind of help yourself first before you even started helping others?
Mm-hmm. So, there's a lot of different side effects per se of post-traumatic stress. And one of them is relationship issues. So after two marriages, I realized that, this is impacting more than just me. I started, trying to make more time for myself, took up a hobby, started woodworking, doing stuff for me. I backed down from having two and three jobs to just one and allowing myself to just be and understand that that's okay. We get so, especially as rookies, you're fresh into it. You want to do everything. You want to be there at the station all the time, ready for the call, but you're forgetting about the other half of your life. And so that was what kind of really made me start my healing process.
Was there anything specifically that you did that was really effective for you in your healing journey?
I wouldn't say there wasn't just one thing. I take that back. It's very cathartic to talk about it and to be open with it. The clinic statistics show that the more you talk about an issue, the easier it is to talk about it and to understand it. So beginning to talk about the issues with peers and coworkers, and I think that more than anything has helped me gain momentum in overcoming what I've dealt with. There's such a stigma, and I know it's been talked about ad nauseum, but it's necessary for everyone to understand that, one, you're not alone. Two, it's okay to not be okay. And three, you don't have to be there. There are things and people out there to help you. And so one of the individuals that responded to me or with me to when I went down to Mississippi after Katrina is a very close friend of mine now. And he is a PhD. He's a clinical psychologist. And we started talking, and he has helped me tremendously as well. So reaching out to the those that are there and using the tools that are available and not being afraid to use them, those are key points for me. So
how have you seen the conversation around these things develop or change over the years that you were working and into the current time? You know, how has that conversation gotten better or not in your experience?
It depends on where you're at. I've found, so I worked in many different agencies in different regions of North Michigan. And then I moved down here to North Carolina, and that's a different culture. It's a different work culture according to the different agency that you work with. The good old boy belief and suck it up and move on if you can't take it while you don't belong in this profession is still very strong. But I do see a transition happening. It's very slow. It's very cautious in many ways. But I do see some positive changes coming. And that's what has to happen. There has to be a paradigm shift in being able to talk to somebody about it and not be chastised and blackballed because you're talking to somebody about it and it's bothering you. You know, I don't know, trigger alert, I don't know anybody out there that with any heart at all that wouldn't have a problem seeing some of the calls that we're on. And I think a lot of that is just education. And people don't stop to think whether it's just not in their, they don't want to, or they just don't think about, oh, that does happen. The things that we see and have to do and smell and hear, and police officers in particular, they're called every day to do things that, just for an example, raising someone else's child, correcting them when they need to be corrected. It's hard. And I think when we get into, and I know I'm going down a rabbit hole here, I think when we get into training the new responders and fresh out of the academy, you know, some of these people are fresh out of high school. They don't have any life experience to draw on to be able to manage these issues when they're called to. Some of them can't even manage themselves, let alone somebody else's emergency issues. So it's a convoluted problem. But I think with documentaries like yours and others that are coming out, it's making the general public more aware of actually what is entailed in this job. And that is paramount. Mm-hmm. We need public education.
Yeah. You know, a few years ago, you know, when you talked about kind of helping to parent, young people, a few years ago, I was working on a film about the opioid crisis, and I was doing some ride-alongs with a local sheriff's, he was a sergeant, the sheriff's department. And he told the story, and part of the film that I was producing, we told the story of this 17-year-old who, got addicted to heroin and we told that story, and she ended up passing away from an overdose at 17 years old. And so that was one part of the story. And I didn't realize that this sergeant was connected to that story until he told me one day that, yeah, I picked her up one day. She was arrested for, she had, paraphernalia on her. And so I was transporting her to the jail, to the juvenile center. And he said, I was just speaking to her about, making good choices and, this is not the way you want to live your life. Mm-hmm. And then it was a few months later, he said, I got the call that she had overdosed, you know, and that kind of impact, I could see how it impacted him. He had tears in his eyes. Here's this big, tough, you know, sergeant on the sheriff's department had tears in his eyes because it was deeply affected. Here's someone he had a relationship with somewhat, you know, as a cop and as a someone he's transporting, a young person, and now she was gone. And so those kind of things can just weigh on someone, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that is very unique about this profession, we are called to incidents that, you know, you go into this house with this family that is in dire straits, or else they wouldn't have called you. You become part of that family, whether you want to or not. You're in that realm, and you're responding as the person that they called for help, as in, you know, dad, help me. And that's, you're part of that family. You can't just take that family away. So, you know, over the course of 20, 30 years in this profession, you've got a big family out there. And every time those something impacts, or, you know, you lose that patient, or one of them goes to jail or suicide or whatever, it pulls from you and it totally impacts you. So one of the analogies that I use when I'm trying to describe psychological trauma to people is that I use it as a snowball. You know, every one of those traumas is a snowflake, and they culminate and they pull together and they create a snowball. You want to stop that snowball before it becomes an avalanche and you can't control it. So that's why I preach, reach out, talk to people so we can melt that snowball. it's difficult.
So just for my clarification, are you retired now?
Semi-retired from the response community. I have, like I said, I realized that I needed to take a step back for my own self and my son. And so I have gone a different route of helping the community. I formed an LLC and am working to not help the citizens per se, but to help first responders. It's called Team Alpha Critical Incident Diffusion Unit. And what we do, and this, what we do, we're aiming to, we should have this operational by June 1st. It came as an epiphany to me one night that these post-traumatic stress, I said before, it's an injury. It's a physiological injury to the brain. So why are we not treating that as an injury? You treat a fractured femur immediately to minimize the trauma, to minimize the pain and the damage. Well, I can live without my leg. I can't live without my brain. So why are we not treating the brain injury immediately? So what my movement, my LLC is, we will respond with a team of clinical professionals, mental health professionals, to the scene of these major incidents, whether it be a line of duty death, you know, a mass casualty incident, whatever, you know, traumas are different for everyone. So we have a cadre of different scenarios that we could respond to, but we respond to be there on scene. We resolve to be there within an hour of the incident or being called. That gives the scene time to calm down and get secure if that's an issue. But it also gives the responders time to start feeling, right? So what we will do is we'll set up a responder rehab area. So refreshments, coffee, water, whatever is necessary, so that they can go over and just take a breather. But that responder rehab area will be manned by at least two clinicians doing some psychological triage, watching for signs of someone that's, and then the other clinicians will be in the unit, which will be a 43-foot RV, fifth wheel RV. So we'll have two clinical areas in the facility, treating them immediately as opposed to letting them go down the road 6 months and letting that trauma seat and fester. So I think that we're going to be able to help a lot of individuals that way. It'll bridge several issues. You know, it will immediately start treating them. It will give them a continuum of care that CISM does not. CISM is good for a diffusion immediately, but then where do you go when the diffusion meeting is done? You go home to your family, who has no clue about what's going on or what you're feeling, and trying to communicate that to your spouse is a lot of times just futile if you try at all, because most of us don't want to involve them. We want to protect them. Well, what does that do? That isolates us even further. So, and that familial relationship is stressed because of that component, the vicarious trauma that comes from that alone on the children, on your spouse. It's terrible. And that lends to another issue, but it will also, this team will also sidestep the intake process that most mental health clinicians require. So you acknowledge that there's a problem and you start seeking help. Okay, so that takes probably a week to find a list of clinicians that have availability and that might seek, might be a specialty area for responders and traumatic injuries. And then, I can see you in 6 weeks. That doesn't help anybody except their billable hours, right? So this will sidestep that because they've already seen a clinician. They've went through that induction process, and the clinician understands because they're right there on scene. They know what he or she went through. They can start addressing the problem immediately. So I see it as a very progressive manner of trying to manage this issue.
Mm-hmm. How do you get buy-in from local agencies, one, to say, hey, it's okay that you guys are on the scene, and two, to have those first responders to actually step into your unit and talk to someone? How do you get that kind of buy-in?
That's a hurdle. And statistics. You have to throw statistics at the command and control and all the agency heads. I have started to reach out to the, not HR, but to risk management, and break down the numbers to show the cost benefit from being proactive in helping your employees that you have now, as opposed to losing that employee, paying them benefits for multiple years down the road, plus what they're going to have to pay out. It all comes down to the almighty buck, what they're going to have to pay out to hire, retrain, fill in on that shift, overtime, and all of the components that come in with hiring a new employee. It's huge.
Sure.
Appealing to their financial and liability aspect is the key, I think. And there is, like I said before, a movement to accept what we're trying to do. There is an understanding. And that is growing from the federal level all the way down to the small volunteer organizations. So I think a lot of that is through attrition. Some of the good old boys are retiring and moving on, and new blood gets in, and they see this and they understand it more, and they're they're willing to feel and to allow others to feel. Mm-hmm. And that's important. So I think that's the key.
So is this what you're offering? Is this something that is you're just providing at no charge to these agencies? It's a free service for them. What's that look like?
Yeah. So it's a tiered response according to the size of the situation, the incident. There is a fee involved, and I toyed with that initially. I thought about seeking grants, and I still am, but for other reasons. But you know, if you get a volunteer, I've managed volunteers for years. And if you get a volunteer that's handed everything, they don't have to put anything into it. They're not going to appreciate it, and they're not going to use that in their. So, I think in the business aspect of this, they expect you get what you pay for. That is a mindset. Sure. That is cross country. So. If they're not paying something for it, they're not going to see the value in it and use it. Well, we don't use it. We don't have to. We're not going to pay it. We're not, no loss, right? So if they pay for it, you know, they're going to expect more, and they're also going to allow their employees to take advantage of it. Therefore, that kind of overcomes that stigma too. If they've got a dog in the fight, well, they're going to want to watch that dog and make sure that dog performs. So we will charge. It'll be a yearly contract for our services, like I said, on a tiered response.
Has this kind of program been done anywhere else in the country?
On a very limited scale. I see several popping up across the country, West Coast a lot. I think LAPD has a unit that is similar, not to the extent that we're doing. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is internal, just for their department, but not to, you know, we're looking to cover, and thank goodness we're not, hopefully not going to experience this calamity where 15 or 20 different agencies are hit all at once, but we're going to be covering, you know, from the base where these units are located, an hour's response time as a response area. So there are a lot of agencies in there that can take advantage of this.
Are you familiar with Lighthouse Health and Wellness? It's a mobile app for first responder agencies. So they were a sponsor, full disclosure, they were a sponsor of my PTSD 911 film, and they also sponsored my Coast to Coast bike tour this past summer. Well, a part of the bike tour, the founder purchased an RV that came along with us, and they had it wrapped with their insignia and their logos and stuff. But his mission, his goal is to create exactly what you're talking about, these units that are response units. And that RV that they purchased for our trip, they're now using that in Orange County to develop that kind of a team. And so maybe that's something that I can connect you to, and you guys can talk and share what you're doing, and he can share what his vision is, because he wants to create these units like this, response units all over the country, and to have this capability. Exactly. So maybe that's something that I can connect you guys, and you can have a conversation about it and see where that goes.
That would be wonderful. You know, the equipment, we can get equipment, but the key component to this is the clinicians. We have to have clinicians that are trained and understand the clientele that we're dealing with. That trust issue is paramount, and if you don't have that, the program won't succeed. So I'd love to speak with them and share successes and failures, you know, because we learn from each other, and we want to make this as successful as possible. And I think that's another key component to treating this problem, in that the psychological community sometimes, and I may be taking a dark turn on this, but sometimes I don't know whether the psychological community really wants to cure the problem. You know, there's
because
billions
it fills their
of
pockets.
Dollars. Right. There's billions of dollars every year spent on mental health care. And that's not including the pharmaceuticals that are prescribed. So what is the incentive to fix the problem? Well, we are the products of that. And so the stance that I take, we have to take care of ourselves. And we have to overcome that. And I've used this analogy before, too. As responders, we are almost mental cannibals for each other. We will eat each other up on scene. If you do something wrong, nobody ever forgets it. We've got to get over that. Everybody's human, and everybody needs something. So, you know, we can't be our own worst enemy because we've got enough enemies out there fighting us as it is. So we got to take care of ourselves.
So in some of the things that you sent me in an email, you talked about the Children Behind the Lines Foundation. What is that, and what is the work that organization does?
So that goes back to the vicarious trauma that comes home with mom or dad from the job. Children don't have the coping mechanisms or the ability to understand at all what's going on. All they see is that mom and dad are fighting, or dad doesn't want to go to my games, or you know, why doesn't he want to play? We've got to help them. But at the same time, we have this stigma of the responder not wanting to reach out because of being labeled by their employer, by their coworkers. Well, I've realized in my personal experience that if you go to your employer and say, "Boss, I've got to go get some help," that immediately triggers, "Oh, you got something wrong with you. We got to put you off from work." But, and your coworkers is the same, if not worse. But if you say, "Boss, my daughter is having issues. I've got to take her to the doctor. I've got to have a couple weeks off to help her." All the troops rally around you and help you. They support you because you're helping your family. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So let's help the family. Let's help the children. But at the same time, that child can't heal unless they are healing as the family, because the family portion of it is the problem. The child's not the problem. So we address the problems with the child by treating the child, the family unit as a whole component, but treating each individual too. So what's included in that? That first responder. He's getting the treatment that he needs under the guise of treating their child. So it's a win-win for the whole family. And you can't heal one without healing the whole. So that's where we're going with that. The Children Behind the Lions Foundation, it's a nonprofit. The paperwork's in. We're just waiting for the feds to say, okay, we'll address that. And the overall goal is to have a facility where these families can go to rebuild, to reunify as a family unit. And that will be not just a two-day retreat. It will be a week. If they need 2 weeks, then we'll take 2 weeks. If it will be someplace where they can go to live in their own home on site and close enough to, you know, they can walk across the courtyard to treatment. We'll have, this is the vision, we'll have equine assisted learning. We'll have gardening, fishing, outside activities, along with the therapeutic components in the clinical setting. But it's not going to be this sterile, you know, you say mental health, everybody envisions a mental health ward. Everything's in, you know, right. rubber rooms. No, this is going to be something relaxing. I personally want log cabins. They're calming. Mm-hmm. They're soothing. You walk into a log home and you can't help but, unless you're allergic to wood, you can't help but say, oh, yeah. So that's what we need. Yeah. We need something to give them a break. And it's got to be remote enough to where the responder with his little miniature on his hip doesn't have an opportunity to make another call. It's going to be remote with enough land around that it's quiet. There's no road noise. There's no airplanes flying over, you know, so that they can truly concentrate on each other. That's the goal of Children Behind the Lines.
Wow, that's pretty ambitious, and that sounds like an amazing, amazing thing. And it looks like you're kind of tackling two different things. And so, how are you going to spend your time with all of this? I guess fundraising for one thing.
that's a lot. Community education, outreach, fundraising in the mix and all of the above, really. It's going to take, unfortunately, a lot of money, but it's out there.
Yeah.
We just have to reach the right person and make them understand the importance of this. And, you know, our infrastructure as a nation depends on our first responders. And so, you know, just for example, NASCAR, they can't operate. They cannot turn a wheel unless there's emergency staff on site. Well, you know, you're relying on us for a lot of money coming in, a lot of revenue. So, you know, come on out and help us. So,
yeah,
that's
sure.
That's how we're spending our time. Wow.
This is amazing, the work that you're doing. There's another thing you listed here. You said, let's do coffee. Is that just time for first responders to connect with each other? What's that all about?
Well, there's so many first responders out there that are ex-military. It's just a natural progression from the military service to back into civilian life. Well, they take over and they become police officers, or the corpsmen become medics. Mm-hmm. And so there's that commonality there. Let's Do Coffee is I've teamed up with the American Legion here in town. And once a month, third Thursday of the month, we just have coffee and donuts. We just pull everybody that wants to come, just come in and sit and talk to people that you can relate to, and bridging that gap, per se. I'm in the process of working with our local police chief and the commander of the local post, the American Legion post, to generate a list of members and ex-military, disabled vets or whomever that are, and I don't like using this term, but it's so descriptive of the problem, shut-ins. They don't go out. They don't want to. They don't feel that they can fit into society anymore. Develop a list of those gentlemen, or ladies and gentlemen, that just need to get out and work with the police chief and the EMS to go pick them up and bring them in for coffee. You know, that bridging that gap there shows, you know, if I was in the shoes of that individual that didn't feel that they could fit into society, having an officer take the time out of his day to come out and just take a ride, go in and have coffee. You know, the relationship that's built in that car in that 15, 20 minute drive can make all the difference in the world. And so that's the goal of that, just to bring people together, give them an out, to be able to talk to somebody. I know most will not, but I've had some success stories. So we've been doing that for almost 2 years now, and it's growing. So that's encouraging.
That's awesome. So what's something that a first responder, perhaps they're watching or listening, and they're like, you know what, I think I may be where Jim was, where I'm kind of noticing something going on in my life. What's a good first step for them to kind of walk toward that journey to a better place?
Don't be afraid to talk about it. You're not going to get well or get better or be in a better spot if nobody else knows about it. Don't isolate. Reach out to those that might not understand. Explain it and don't hold back. A lot of the reason that the community doesn't understand what we're going through is because we don't tell them. So, talk about it, and, you don't have to be graphic, but there's ways to tell people what you experienced without grossing them out and turning them off. This whole problem is this white elephant that nobody wants to dance with at the party. We've gotta make people aware. And so reach out to, those that, are out there to help and support you. And that's another goal of mine. Yeah, I've got a couple, is to, establish, an easier way to find resources. When you're in this trauma, when your mind is in that fight or flight mode, you don't have the rational thought processes. You just can't. It's physiologically impossible. So to try and sit down in front of a computer and search, linear thought is beyond you. So how can you find help? Well, it has to be easy. It has to be right there in front of you. So if there's maybe a coworker, maybe a relative, maybe somebody walking down the street that you heard was a veteran or was a first responder, retired, just talk to them, reach out to them. And don't be afraid, because it's not going to get any better unless we take on that, the responsibility. And, there's purpose in the pain. I don't know whether you've heard that phrase before, but we've experienced it. We've gone through it. And that's not going to change. The fact that it happened, we can't change that. What we can change is how we manage it, how we interpret it, and what we do with it. So if I've seen a lot, I've not seen as much as many people have, but I believe that I've seen that for a reason, so that I can reach out to others and help them, putting purpose to that pain. Start volunteering someplace. Just get out and do. I think is key to that healing process.
I really like that purpose to pain. I think that's something that's I'll probably name this episode. That would be the title for the episode. That is so important. And in looking at my own life and just reading and understanding the human being, understanding that the human journey, we don't learn much on the easy things. We don't learn much on the easy days. It's the hard days that we learn the most. And if we can turn that pain of hard times and hardships into something that can learn and that can help us move forward, then that's where that experience can turn into a positive, instead of just sucking us down into depression and hopelessness.
Oblivion. I was told throughout my journey through school, you can't learn unless you make a mistake, but you got to capitalize on it and correct it and move on. So, these issues that we're dealing with might not necessarily be mistakes, the underrating cause, but we can learn from the negative impact that has happened to us and grow from that. Mm-hmm. So, and that's on us to grow. And take that and move forward.
Awesome. Well, is there anything else that you want to share as we wrap up here? Is there anything else you want to, that's front of mind for you?
I just really appreciate the opportunity to do this. And I applaud you for your work. It's so important to reach out and to spread this information. And like I said, community education is paramount. We have to be proactive and letting people know, or else nothing is ever going to change. So again, I thank you for this opportunity.
Thanks, Jim, for spending time with me on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing what you guys do in working to bring like a critical response team right to the scene. I'm really excited about that and seeing how that develops. And big thanks to all of you who have taken time to listen, to watch, and especially those of you who have left a review. I really appreciate it. And if you haven't left a review, please do so. I really want to hear from you to know what you enjoy, what you don't enjoy, so that I can produce better content for you in the future. So thanks so much for leaving those reviews. And remember, you are not alone. If you need someone to talk to and you don't know where you can turn, you can dial 988 for help. So be sure to tune in next week for another interview with an amazing first responder leader. And until then, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something great in the world.